Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori on this Saturday morning, April 6, 2019. How are we doing this morning? So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. And you can hear us from anywhere online by going to 883wppb.org. You can hear the show on various podcasts, and every show is archived on my website at annliguori.com. Well, I'm in Augusta, Georgia. Yes, it's that time of year again, one of my favorite times of the year. Masters Week really doesn't officially start until Monday, but there is a groundbreaking event happening today at Augusta National, and that is the final round for the Augusta National Women's Amateur. It's a first here at Augusta. After the field of 72 invited women based on their positions in the Women's World Amateur Golf Ranking and performances at various tournaments, played this past Wednesday and Thursday at a course called Champions Retreat in Evans, Georgia. The top 30 players from the original 72 moved on to today's final. And boy, what a great opportunity for these girls who, whether or not they made the cut or didn't make the cut, they had an opportunity to play Augusta National yesterday in a practice round. And it was indeed an experience of a lifetime. This entire championship has been handled with such class, and it will be great to watch these women compete today in this inaugural Augusta National Women's Amateur. Jennifer Kupcho is the one to watch. She's the number one ranked amateur golfer in the world, a senior at Wake Forest, the reigning NCAA individual champion. And she's just been playing stellar. Tomorrow, Sunday, is the annual drive, chip, and putt competition for junior players. Now, 80 junior golfers representing 27 U.S. states and four Canadian provinces have earned an invitation to Augusta National to compete in what is now the sixth annual drive, chip, and putt national finals. It's conducted in partnership with the Masters Tournament, the PGA of America, and the United States Golf Association. The program is free. It's part of this nationwide youth golf development program open to boys and girls ages 7 to 15. There are four different age categories, and, of course, the three competitions are accuracy in driving, chipping, and putting. And if you'd like more information on perhaps how your child can qualify, you can visit their website. It's drivechipandputt.com. Well, a lot going on this weekend. The ANA Inspiration, it's the first major on the women's calendar. It's going on at Mission Hills Country Club in Rancho Mirage, California. Unfortunately, in terms of scheduling, for these top women players in the world, both professional and amateur. It's the same exact weekend as this Augusta National Women's Amateur. So obviously it would be better if one of these championships was rescheduled. We'll have to see what happens in the future. But the ANA Inspiration, they invite top women amateurs to compete in their championship too. So it's hard to have both of these huge events for women happening on the same weekend. Also big in the news, obviously, you've been following it. If you're into golf, Matt Kuchar, Sergio Garcia. Boy, what a controversy during their match play at the WGC Dell last weekend. Sergio missing that 6-inch putt, not waiting for Kuchar to give it to him to say it's good, which is done normally with a putt that short. In match play. But Sergio was not only upset about missing such a short putt, he was also teething that Kuchar didn't give it to him. And Kuchar said that Sergio didn't look up and didn't have a chance to give him the putt. Well, a day later, the two made a video together, both sitting in a golf cart with Kuchar's arm around Sergio and that big Kuch smile. And I tell you, if you saw that video, it was as phony as could be. It was supposed to be like it's an all good statement by these two golfers, but it just came out just so phony and bogus. So not well for their image, and both of them have been suffering in the image department of late. Obviously, Kuchar with not adequately tipping his caddy when he won a tournament in Mexico earlier this year. And the way Sergio has been handling just his bad play, just losing his temper, acting worse than a child would act in a temper tantrum by scuffing up greens and bunkers in Dubai. Just terrible, terrible behavior. So these two need to reassess how they're handling things. And what happened this past weekend didn't help, that's for sure. So interesting stories going on in the world of golf. Of course, the Masters week starts Monday. Competition starts Thursday. And who are you picking to win the Masters? Well, Kevin Kisner just won the match play last Sunday. I don't think he's going to win Tiger. I don't think Tiger's going to win, although what a story it would be if the four-time Masters champion could win his fifth Masters. That would just be incredible in his 15th major. But I just don't think it's going to happen for Tiger. I don't see him putting four just incredibly great rounds together. He'll probably maybe, you know, put one or two together, but four straight. And, you know, he had neck stiffness earlier in the year, which caused him to pull out of Arnold Palmer Invitational. He lost in the quarterfinal match last weekend, which was probably better for him so he could rest, get more rest before this Masters. Who knows? You know, it just depends on how his body is going to handle it. He can't play as much. He can't practice as much. But obviously, to win the Masters, the most prestigious major on the calendar, is something every player wants to do, and Tiger would want to do it worse than anybody else, practically. So it will be interesting to see him doing it. I'm going to go with Rory McIlroy in what will be his fifth attempt now to win a career Grand Slam. He is ready. I mean, he's playing so well now. He won the Players' Championship. His putting seems to be back on track. His confidence is back as well. I'm going to go for Rory McIlroy. I think this Masters is his time. He's peaked at the right moment so far, and I think he's going to do it. He needs to do, you know, obviously deal with all the pressure on the final Sunday, and you know, that's hard to do. You don't want to beat yourself. So, but if he just drives the ball beautifully, he can stay accurate and long off the tee and make those putts. I really think Rory McIlroy could win his first Masters title and complete the career Grand Slam. Well, a few weeks ago, I was at the Valspar Championship, which I cover every year, and my alma mater, University of South Florida, located in Tampa, Florida, they every year take a hospitality suite overlooking the 18th green, and I love taping interviews in this suite and catching up with just different personalities from University of South Florida and from the golf world who are there from the Valspar Championship. And it's so enlightening. It really kind of keeps me updated and my audience updated on what is going on in college athletics and academics. And this morning, we are going to hear several of these interviews. Stephen Bradley, USF's men's golf coach, will talk about his program and issues affecting college golf overall. Bill McCausland, the director of Alumni Association for University of South Florida. Just fascinating material from Bill, and Tracy West, one of the few women who are tournament directors for a PGA Tour event, and she is the tournament director of the Valspar Championship. So Tracy West will join me as well. Sports Interview with Anne Liguori is brought to you in part by Dune Jewelry and the Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. Dune Jewelry, that's DUNE jewelry.com. and sports interview is brought to you in part by Peak Vision Sunglasses. P-E-A-K Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game. PeakVision.com. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. We are at the Valspar Championship, just north of Tampa, Florida, in the University of South Florida booth, overlooking the 18th green. And joining me is Tracy West, the tournament director. 5 years, Tracy, and always so wonderful, A, to see you, and B, to see a woman doing her thing in a still a very dominantly man's world.
Yeah, absolutely, it is. But it's just terrific to be able to be part of the PGA Tour, PGA Tour Golf. Certainly, there's a lot of females involved at the PGA Tour level, and certainly at different PGA Tour tournaments. But yeah, I think there's only three of us that are PGA Tour tournament directors right now. So it's fun. I mean, the pros, it doesn't faze them at all. I mean, we're just one of the guys, just like any of the other tournament directors.
Funny you say one of the guys, because last year at Bay Hill, I asked Tiger Woods a question, and he looked at me and said, "Dude," and then he went on and answered this question, and I almost fell out of my chair, and so did everybody else in the media room, but I think that was out of familiarity. You know, it wasn't like an insult or anything, so you probably get called dude occasionally.
Oh, I absolutely do, and it's absolutely fine with me. In fact, I prefer that they think of me that way, and so it's a lot of fun.
Talk about the field here this year, Tracy. You have Dustin Johnson, John Rahm, Jason Day, Sergio, Bubba. Everybody's yelling Bubba. They love Bubba Watson here. Patrick Reed. It's a strong field, even though Tiger opted not to come, and Brooks Koepka decided not to come.
Yeah, it is a strong field, and I think that's a testament to the Copperhead. The players really respect and love this course. Many of them will say it's their favorite course on the PGA Tour in Florida. So we're happy with the field we have. It's what we try and do is make sure that's an event. So it's not only all about PGA Tour players and coming out and watching them. It certainly is important. But we want to make sure that we do a lot of different activities for our fans and really make sure that this is the place to be in Tampa Bay during our week.
And this is such a unique tournament. The signage here and the creativity that you all do to showcase Valspar, the paint company, is ingenious. It's so colorful. There's so many fun areas for adults and kids, and it's just so much fun to kind of walk around and see everything that goes on here.
Yeah, Valspar is a terrific company, and they fully believe and activate around our tagline, which is the most colorful PGA Tour tournament in the world. And so they believe it, and they live it, and they breathe it. So we're so fortunate to have them. They really take extra investment and make sure that there's really fun fan areas. They've got color scouts roaming the course. All the fans that come dressed colorfully, they hand out prizes, over 10,000 prizes over the 4 days. They bring in tiny homes and paint them in the Valspar colors of the year, and people can go in and experience those. They have a lot of different activation areas where you can take pictures and share them on social media. So those are just some examples of what they do. So they're a terrific title sponsor. And then we certainly add things as well. We've got a lot of different seating areas. So it's not just all about corporate hospitality or bleachers. We have fun fan areas for people to sit. So we have a 10,000 square foot beach, the largest beach on the PGA Tour, with 300 Adirondack chairs. And they can see a 50-ton chameleon, sand sculpture chameleon. We've got wine garden areas. We've got margarita decks. Whiskey lounges. We've got so many different spots that people can enjoy the tournament. We added a chill lounge this year, which is an area with three concession tents during the day. And at night, Thursday nights and Friday nights, we keep it open and all the furniture lights up. So it's LED furniture and with 500 Beats headphones for a silent disco. So we really try and do different things here for sure.
Is that the area where they had the plastic furniture? I loved it. And when the sun was hitting the furniture, I took some of the pictures because it looks like, you know, neon white. And there was an area for the DJ, and Publix was probably one of the sponsors. And it's really clever. So that's new this year.
That is new this year. And then we also partnered and created another new area. We actually partnered with USF and the Vinick School of Business, or Les Moomis School of Business. It is a Fortnite area. So we've got 8 gaming consoles, and we've got on Saturday a nationally gaming expert called Yo-Yo Keep It Up. His name is Yo-Yo Keep It Up, and he's going to teach everyone how to play Fortnite. So just further examples of how to make sure that there's so many fun things to do here.
Can I talk about the concert, the big concert on Saturday?
Yes, we're very fortunate to have Brad Paisley. So this will be our 5th year that we're doing Valspar Live. So anyone that has a Saturday tournament ticket, they can come out, watch golf, enjoy all the other things we talked about. And then right after play, they can wander over to our second driving range here at Innisbrook, and we build a full-fledged concert, and Brad Paisley will be performing.
I love it. Brad Paisley, all you country music fans are going to love that. So talk a little bit more about this golf course, Copperhead. It's you know, walking around, you can't really get a sense of the elevation on TV until you really walk it. There's a lot of elevation here. It kind of reminds me of the elevation at Augusta National, because you can't tell how many hills are on that golf course by watching it on TV either. There's a lot of elevation here at Copperhead.
Yeah, you make an excellent point. It's exactly like that. You can't tell how elevated the Copperhead is. And the same thing, I remember my first time going to Augusta National, and I was like, wow, this is so much hillier than you thought. It's such a different course in Florida, the Copperhead, because of the elevation, because of the types of trees. I always tell people you can blindfold someone, airdrop them in here, take the blindfold off and ask, what state are you in? And they're going to say North Carolina. They're not going to say Florida.
I love it. And so the players love to play it. It's great grass. Right. Do you know what kind of grass is on the fairway?
Yeah. Well, they've changed everything to Tiff Eagle. So Bermuda and Tiff Eagle on the greens. So in 2015, Sheila Johnson made a major investment into the Copperhead and did a restoration. So it's a wonderful Larry Packer design golf course. But it just needed some different grasses to make sure that it's in top condition, really not only for the tournament, but all year round. So she made that investment. We changed all the grasses on the golf course. Retweaked some of the greens just to get a few more pin placements for the PGA Tour when they're here. Reshaped some of the bunkers back to being what Larry Packard's original design concept was. And it really turned out terrific, and the pros love it.
I love it. Now, you work with Hollis Kavner of Pro Links Sports. And you also, after this, you have a big event coming up, the Masters. You work in the hospitality area of the Masters. Tell us what you do up there, and it must be so exciting to work at that part of it.
Yeah, so we actually we've got some offsite homes. So we work with some of our big corporate sponsors at our different tournaments and bring them up there and make sure that their clients and guests have a great time in the evenings after the Masters and make sure that they get there safe and sound as well. And then we focus on our other PGA Tour events that we manage. We manage the Wells Fargo Championship in Charlotte. And then the new 3M Open, which is a new PGA Tour event in Minneapolis. It used to be a Champions Tour event for many years, but it's joining the PGA Tour event this year. And then we've got several other Champions Tour events that we manage too. So we're definitely a busy company, and Hollis has a terrific vision, and it's a joy. We've got a great team.
So Minneapolis in July, the Freedom Open, new PGA Tour event. I guess they're excited, right? I'm trying to remember, when was the last time a PGA Tour event was in Minneapolis?
Yeah, for annually, I'm not sure there has been. They certainly get the Hazeltine will certainly host the U.S. Open. They had the Ryder Cup there, obviously, a couple of years ago. But they're a hotbed for golf. I mean, there's more golfers per capita in Minnesota than there is in any other state in the country. So they love their golf. The fans are going to come out in droves for these guys. 3M's a terrific sponsor. The TPC of Twin Cities is where the golf course is. 3M's a great sponsor. So it's going to be a terrific, terrific event up there. And I think a lot of people are going to come out and spend their July 4th at that event.
You're absolutely right about how much Minnesota loves golf, right? I mean, Hazeltine was off the wall. I mean, as far as enthusiasm goes, as far as the hospitality goes, they're very hospitable people. It was one of the best events that I've ever been a part of, watching, a Ryder Cup. And just remember how wonderful the people are there, really. I mean, I'm sure this PGA Tour event's going to be exciting, and I'm sure the people are so excited to have another event to go to.
Yeah, absolutely. We've had golf there since our first Champions Tour event was in 1993 there, and people just came out in droves. I remember the first Monday of that event. And typically at a Champions Tour event, there's not a lot of people out on a Monday, right? You know, there's a pro-am. And people started just streaming in the gates, and they were sitting on the driving range, and we didn't even have any pros out there yet. It was, the pro-am was a late morning, and I remember Hollis, you know, calling me on the radio saying, start calling all the hotels where the pros are and get them out here. You know, we've got people just sitting waiting for them. So Minnesotans love their golf.
So let's backtrack a little bit, back to the Masters. You're here at the Valspar, and there's top players here. We don't know who's going to win this event, but in a couple weeks, the Masters will be upon us. And who's your pick?
Well, you know, certainly I would love to see, you know, Jordan be able to, you know, rally back and, you know, have his game be in top form by then. But I, you know, the eye of the Tiger, there's no question that I think Tiger will contend. But it's, Augusta National is so tough. There's really so many different players that can win. So it's really who's going to, you know, be in top form coming off of here. Because certainly the Copperhead is probably the most similar golf course that they play this calendar year leading into Augusta National. So we'll kind of see who's in top form and who does well this week, and they're a pretty good bet for the next couple weeks at Augusta.
Absolutely. I mean, you got to figure Rory McIlroy, who won the Players' Championship, he'd love to complete the career Grand Slam and, you know, have a strong, very strong season. But you're right, having played here, the preparation for Augusta National is a no-brainer. Were you happy with the schedule change, or would you prefer it a couple weeks, or like when it was in earlier March?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the players coming back into March does throw a wrinkle into the schedule, you know, for all the other three events, the Honda, you know, Bay Hill, and ourselves. But in the end, we're fine. We look at it as we've got the Copperhead. You know, that's our best shining gem. And, you know, there was certainly some trepidation leading into this season, but with the field we ended up with this week, really put, I think, those fears and alleviated those concerns. So we feel good about our spot in the schedule, and we want to definitely be part of the Florida Swing, and or at least in the spring for sure.
It was great to see Dustin Johnson playing, because he hasn't played here in a while, right?
Yeah, not since 2010. So Dustin hasn't been here since 2010. Jason Day hasn't been here since 2013. John Rahm's never played here. So it's the schedule's been interesting, the change. You know, those three guys don't typically play here. But a few of the guys that we normally get, we didn't get this year. So it's kind of interesting, but I think in a way it's kind of fun because the fans get to see some guys that they haven't seen for quite some time.
Different players, and you know, as much as you want everybody to be here, they have to take a break. And where do they, you know, with 6-7 straight weeks of PGA Tour events, which tournament do they sit out? And being so close to the Masters, you're going to get some guys who really want to play. And look, Tiger can't play that much anymore. He even said it. He had a neck issue which pulled him out of Bay Hill. He didn't play the Honda, which was right in his own backyard. His neck got tight in L.A., got worse in Mexico, he was saying last week. And he just said, I can't practice as much and I can't play as much. And I think the golf world has to get used to the fact that even if he's healthy, he can't play as much golf.
Well, yeah, it's tough not only for him, but really all these guys. I mean, their bodies, I mean, they're such great athletes, but how hard they swing now, their swing speeds, everything. I mean, it is tougher even on the younger guys. I mean, their backs, everything. They've got to take some time off. And as much as every tournament would love, as you said, to have every single guy here, it's just not realistic. So as long as we have a good collection of guys each year, we're happy. And I think our fans are happy because, again, they're coming out to see these guys, but there's so many more things that they're coming out for. So we're really pleased with where we ended up.
So you go back. You said there are three women who are tournament directors. Can you tell me who they are?
Yeah, so it's myself. I started, this will be my fifth year, Marcy Doyle at the Bay Hill. So she started a couple years, I think, after me. And then I'm going to draw a blank on her name, but she in Memphis. Julie, I'm drawing a blank, but there's... Well, Julie Tyson's at in New York, but I'm not remembering the other girl. She's new. This is her first year, so that's why I'm not remembering.
PGA Tour does a good job at hiring women, because as I go around to these, you know, tournaments, I do see a lot of women working in their office, whether it's media, communications, upper management. I think that's a strong thing to recognize the PGA Tour for.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the perfect example is Alex Baldwin. Alexandra Baldwin was just named as the president of the Web.com Tour. So she's the first female to lead a PGA Tour, a division, of the PGA Tour, not with in-house, but, I mean, you know, one of the tours themselves. So, and she's terrific. I've known her a long time from Boston, and she's the perfect woman for this. So I think Commissioner Monahan is a firm believer in supporting women, supporting diversity, and he puts his money where his mouth is, for sure.
Tracy West, always a pleasure to catch up. Continued success, and thanks for joining me here in the USF booth overlooking the 18th green at the Valspar Championship. And congratulations on their renewal, by the way. They've renewed through 2025, which is wonderful.
Yeah, it really is. Again, it just shows that their belief in golf, what it does for their brand. And really, I think when they started off in 2014 as our title sponsor, it was all about building the Valspar brand. But since then, it's really morphed into that. The branding is still important, but it's morphed into the client entertainment, the relationships that they're building with their clients as they entertain them here, and really what they're doing in the community. Even though they're part of Sherwin-Williams now, which is based in Cleveland, they have a real strong affinity for the Tampa Bay region, real strong affinity for their relationship with the PGA Tour. It's not only this tournament, but they sponsor the Valspar Caddy Hat Program. So really a bunch of the caddies all throughout the season wear their hat, and they help obviously support the caddies through doing that. So I think they understand the business side of this and the affiliation with the tour and the affiliation with charity. So there's just so many win-win touch points. I think it was an easy decision for them to renew through 2025.
It certainly is the most colorful tournament on the schedule. Tracy West, thanks again for joining me.
Thank you, Ann.
Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. I am at the Valspar Championship, in just north of University of South Florida. It's located in Tampa, Florida. And joining me is Michael Kelly, the VP of USF Athletics. And Michael, your resume is unbelievable. If you are in sports, you've had so many incredible experiences in the world of sports. And I don't know where you want to start. You were with the Marlins, the ACC. You were recently, the COO of the College Football Playoff. I mean, talk about a resume. You're a superstar.
Oh, thank you. I'm so grateful for the number of different opportunities I've had. It's been amazing, really, when I look back and just see kind of what it started. And it really just came from people who were willing to give me an opportunity. I try to take the best advantage of those. And then you just develop relationships and build confidence in people in you. And it's just been kind of a magical ride so far.
You were born in Washington, D.C., were raised in Washington, D.C., went to Wake Forest. What did you study?
I was a political science major at Wake. I studied some business somewhat as a minor, but really enjoyed it. I also had Dr. Maya Angelou was a professor of mine at Wake Forest, and that was a real thrill for me, too. So that's something I always remember from my undergraduate days. It was amazing.
Wow. Were you a poet person?
I wasn't a poet, but I just remember reading her books and literature in high school, and then to understand that I could maybe attend some of her classes at Wake, and fortunately my senior year I had a chance to do that.
And you got your graduate degree in Miami?
I did. I went to St. Thomas University in Miami, and they really specialized in sports administration. That field is quite, there's so many schools that offer that now, but back in the early 90s when I was doing it, there weren't that many. There were a handful, and I chose St. Thomas because it was the Miami area was at a boom in sports at the time, and it was mostly nighttime classwork. It gave me a chance to do a lot of things by day to get the experience I needed. I felt good about my education. I knew I could do a lot of things and understand things, but I didn't have the experience that I needed, and St. Thomas in the Miami area allowed me to do that early on.
Were you always an athlete or just interested in sports as a youth?
I was always very interested in sports as a fan growing up in the D.C. area. I was a very focused high school basketball player in the D.C. area, so I was a starter for my team. We were in a very competitive kind of nationally ranked type of a program, but I was just more of a role player, but that was a big part of my life when I was in high school, but not could have probably played at some level in college, but not to where I wanted to be at the top level. It just wasn't that gifted.
So then you were with the Marlins when they first became a baseball franchise?
I was the first intern in Marlin history in that. I literally was starting in 1993 in January, was starting the St. Thomas program, as I mentioned. I put everything that I had in my car, drove up there, and before I even went to the apartment I was going to live in, I went to what was then Pro Player Stadium, where the Marlins were getting ready to play their first year. Went in there and said, what can I do? The Marlins gave me a job in the kind of telemarketing and making calls for season tickets. And that led into, after 2 months of that, into being their kind of their marketing and communications intern. So that was just a really fun experience to be there for opening day and beyond for that opportunity.
Could you ever imagine back then that Derek Jeter would become a part owner of the Florida Marlins?
No, I would have never envisioned that. Just can't even remember where he was in his playing career at that time. But it was I love seeing that in the inaugural year because I was able to watch so many professionals almost in the front office that I still know some of them today. And looking back now, they were probably really young executives then and making mistakes and not knowing what to do as an inaugural year. So it was really kind of fun to see what happened. But it springboarded a lot of things. And it gave me a greater love for the sports industry and opened my eyes to a lot of different things.
And you have a lot of experience working, you know, with the Super Bowl. So talk about all these experiences that you had moving on to football.
Yeah, a lot of the unique things about my career are that I've been a president of four different what we call local organizing committees. One for the men's Final Four, one was held here in the Tampa-St. Petersburg area back in 1999, and then three different Super Bowls, one in Tampa in 2001, one in Jacksonville in 2005, and one in Miami in 2007. So I kind of made the state tour, and the unique things about those, of course, they're great jobs. They're hard jobs in that you have so many details to, you know, fundraising, public safety, the planning all the different parties, making sure things are perfect for the teams. But basically, in many ways, to summarize it, it's almost like being the advanced team for the NFL because they might not focus on it till 1 month out. Your job is to focus on it 2 years out and make sure everything's kind of ready. So that was just fun to learn the communities, learn everything about the, obviously, what's one of the largest events in the world, like the Super Bowl. And it developed just a huge network of people that you met in so many different aspects of the business. And just so grateful for people giving me a chance at that stage to learn that and kind of get become a better manager and professional.
And then how did you make the transition, Michael, to college football?
Well, college was always my goal and my focus. I always knew I felt more comfortable in that environment. But when these Super Bowl opportunities kind of came about, it was something I just couldn't turn down. And there's always transferable skills. But in the midst of some of those Super Bowl runs, I did work at the University of South Florida under Leroy Selman. And I had worked previously at Wake Forest as well. So I had some stints as on campus experience. But the relevancy to what I do now and the emotional attachment I have to what I do now really came a lot from working with Leroy. Just the great gentleman that he was, the great not only person on the field, but what he did to help establish the USF Athletic Department in so many ways was inspiring to me. And when this opportunity came up to know I could kind of come back, even though I was kind of more like his number two guy, to come back, you know, 16 years later and try to finish what's been started is a real honor for me.
Of course, Leroy Selman, Hall of Famer, Tampa Bay Buccaneers, gone way too soon, but what an impact he had on the university. And he kind of came right in and everybody loved him, and he could get meetings with anybody here in Tampa and nationally. Everybody knew Leroy Selman, and so what a thrill it must have been for you to work under him. I mean, and he was so humble. You didn't realize what a big shot he was, right? I mean, it must have been just so cool to work for him.
It really was. Because I still remember vividly, I was 6 years old when the Buccaneers were established, living up in the D.C. area, like you mentioned, and I remember when the Bucs came out, and he was their first draft pick, so even from afar, just following what he did and then going to a Hall of Fame career. So then to 15, 20 years later to not only meet him, become friends with him, but to work for him was special. And to see someone that was so strong and such a great football player, but how kind and gentle and how he made everyone feel important, how he was so personable, That he remains the standard of how we want our employees and our student athletes to present themselves, but also to emulate and treat people in terms of how we're trying to build the culture and the notoriety of USF Athletics.
So you've been here for about almost a year here at University of South Florida, and talk a little bit about the athletic programs here. It seems like all cylinders are in full force, and there's a lot of excitement generating in a lot of different sports here.
There are. You know, we have 19 different sports, so there's a lot to keep up with. My wife and I joke sometimes that basically we've got 475 kids that we didn't raise in our house because you've got that many. That's how many student athletes we have. But we have such great coaches here. They care about our young people. And competitively, we continue to get better. So many of our sports are doing quite well. Our football program, we've only had a program for football for 21 years. We won our 150th game this past fall, which is faster than any program in the state of Florida has ever done. It's faster than the Canes, the Gators, the Noles, the Knights. So I think sometimes, even though there's ebbs and flows it's so instantaneous in society today when you lose a game, win a game. But to look back and just take a step back, that's just a great credit to the Paul Griffins and Leroy Selmans of the world that got the program started, to the coaches that we've had and the players we've had, and, of course, the donors that have kind of made it happen. The USF community should be very proud of that accomplishment. But we're not satisfied with that, and that we know we got to build up to inject more dollars into our program for our kids every day. We were in the midst of building a facility to make our program more viable and sustainable for the future as well.
I remember the whole nation was watching when USF football went 7-0. That was pretty spectacular.
It really was. We were ranked, and we've been ranked in the top 25 at some point for four straight years now, and that's wonderful. Again, 150 wins, four straight years being ranked, four straight bowl games. Again, all great metrics that are moving us in the right direction. So a lot to look forward to going forward.
Michael, when I was a student here, we didn't have a football team. It was all about basketball. Lee Rose was the head coach. The Sun Dome had just opened. It was this huge new concept in arena, architecture with the dome and air keeping it afloat. Remember those days? That was crazy. Yes, so talk a little bit about the basketball and how both the men's and women's teams are doing.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked, because basketball being such a passion for me personally, and as you said, we have a good tradition in it because that was our main sport for so long. But now to be able to work with both programs together, our men's and women's, our women have become perennially a top 25 caliber program under Jose Fernandez. He's been at it for 19 years now. He's one of only seven employees that was here the last time I was here, so he and I have a long run together, and so proud of what his program's established. And then in the last 2 years now, Brian Gregory being our coach now on the men's side, we really had hit somewhat of a rock bottom. We had been under 10 wins for a couple of years in a row. Our kids weren't performing that well in the classroom. Now, within a two-year turnaround, our kids are performing well in the classroom. We won 20 games already this year. We've still been involved in the postseason tournament right now in the CBI. So we're taking steps in the right direction. So to me, I'm bullish on it because – we are, for basketball fans, just people that like the sport, we're the sole outlet for it here in the Tampa Bay market. We truly are Tampa Bay's home for hoops. Of course, we've got the Magic if people want to go to Orlando to see the NBA hour or two down the road. But that's why I'm just so confident we can get even more interest in it, especially as we're developing the types of caliber programs we are. So I'm excited about the future of USF basketball. I'm convinced it will be. We're going to reach a level that we've never reached before, particularly in terms of considering both programs together at once.
And going back a little bit to the football program, there's a big sign here in the booth at the Valspar about that indoor football facility, the training center. That looks incredible.
Oh, yeah, we're pleased with the designs. It's going to be first class. It'll be a transformational step in our program. We've built great facilities. All of our programs are in pretty good shape. But as we've gone, when you look in cycle, you can't rest, and that's going to be the next key thing for us. Part of it is a indoor practice facility just to give us some shelter from the weather and stay as disciplined and keep our efficiencies as good as we can. Because my first 38 days here, 36 days, we had one of those thunderstorms that threw off practice in some capacity. And in this good era of changes that have happened to student-athletes where we really only have 20 hours to work with them, when you've got so many things that are a week, that is, to work with folks, it's caused us to be more efficient. And as silly as it sounds, you'd lose an hour here or there. Maybe in the old days, it'd be like, hey, no big deal. We'll practice at 4. We'll come back. But, hey, we've got trainers that are got on a strict schedule. We've got our academic tutors. We've got our kids that need to live their own life and be able to get back and study. So just having the efficiency and knowing you can count on how to plan and train is important for the indoor practice facility side. We also just need to, on the football operations side of that building, we just need more capacity for our football players to have some things to, places to rest, places to study. We wanted to make it the one-stop shop for them to do it. The great thing about the culture of what everyone's buying in on this is that because when we do that, of course it's going to be big and great for football, but what the space they vacate in our current Leroy Selman Athletic Center is going to be something we can share more with all the rest of our 18 programs. So it's going to be a big boost for our entire program, and that's why it's so vital to our future success.
And talk a little bit about the new offensive coordinator that was hired in football. He came from Florida, right?
Yeah, well, Kerwin Bell is our new offensive coordinator. He actually was the head coach at Valdosta State last year, which won the Division II national championship. He was he's well known in this marketplace because he was, as you mentioned, a former All-SEC Player of the Year when he was a player at Florida. He went on to, I think, a 17-year career in various pro leagues. So he knows the game. He's been coaching for a long time, and he's got a very dynamic offense that has been something that I think will be exciting for our fans. I know our young men love the way it puts them in space to make plays, and they're very excited about his leadership. So, and the great thing is that he has a great relationship with Coach Strong because Coach Strong was a GA when Kerwin was a player at Florida. So they've known each other for decades now. And so to have that kind of camaraderie between your offensive coordinator and your head coach is just breathing a lot of excitement to our program this year, and we're excited about getting started here in a couple. We just started spring practice, but obviously getting ready for the big season coming up with when we start it in August.
Michael, you've had such varied experiences, both in college and pros, with different sports organizations. In college, you read almost every week about, scandals that hit universities and athletic programs. How does one kind of keep stay away from all that and keep, the staff and the students on the straight and narrow?
Well, when you're talking about so many people, as I said, we've got 475 young people that are our student athletes, men and women, between probably 18 to 22. You've got 200-plus staff members in the athletic department. You've got so many different dynamics with our donors and everything else. So there's a lot of things. And the bottom line is they're all humans, and things are going to happen. And it's really a matter of how do you stay calm, how do you try to stay ahead of it when things happen, how do you handle it? And you've got to handle it in a first-class manner and move on. And your first hope, of course, is that everything happens smoothly and we do it by the book, and that's exactly what we do from the administrative side. But you mainly just have to learn from everything that you see. Just the things that you saw last week about some of the admissions processes with some schools across the country. Every time you see someone encounter something, you've got to step back and not say, well, that would never happen here. You've got to take a look at it and say, okay, the challenge of my staff to say, okay, if that happened here, what would we do? What would we be doing right now? How can we prepare ourselves to it? Or, what can we make sure we can guard against that we're even beyond what we're doing now to make sure that doesn't happen? And so everything needs to be a learning experience. We just have kind of a calm demeanor about myself. I try to instill that in others and just stay confident, stay courteous and friendly to people, much like Leroy Selman set the model for us, and to just be prepared. Just have to be prepared to adjust and be smart. We've got to learn from everything.
You have such a calm demeanor. It's so great to see. But college sports has become such a big business. Do you see that as a negative, or can you work under those parameters?
It's a reality of it. I mean, the reason I've wanted to be in college sports is the goal is because while there is a business aspect to it and you have to follow those type of principles and realize the realities, I still believe dearly in the fact that there is a greater mission than simply the wins and losses and the dollars and cents. And the fact that these young people are truly changing their lives and hopefully the course of their families for generations to come by going to college. I don't have the percentages in front of me, but there's a sizable percentage of our young men and women that are student athletes at USF that are probably the first in their family to go to college. And to think that for them to have that opportunity, we know the numbers are slim that they're going to play necessarily as a professional athlete, but they're going to get that degree from USF, potentially, if they play their cards right, even a master's degree from USF while they're competing for us. And that's a great opportunity. What do they make out of that? They'll come out of it debt-free by being fully scholarshiped. And so that mission still means a lot to me. I know some people get cynical about it when they look at things, but the bottom line is there's a handful of athletes that are just super amazing athletes that are going to go pro, but those percentages are few and are very small, and examples are few and far between. Core mission is to get people to graduate from school and better their lives, all while doing it in a championship experience and by enjoying their the love of their sport to do it.
Sure. And one of the big issues in college sports is, you know, do college athletes deserve to get paid? There are a lot of athletes that come to these programs, you know, on full scholarship, but can't afford perhaps to even buy their books or, you know, to have any kind of extra, you know, living expenses at all. So how do you feel about that issue, Michael? And do you think it might be a reality in the future that, you know, the whole system may change and athletes might have to get paid?
It could be. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of there's a lot of litigation going on now to examine that the amateurism model that the NCAA has been coping with for a while, and we'll have to see what kind of rulings come out and how we would adjust to that. What a big push in the last 3 or 4 years has been to try to at least enhance the amount of opportunities that student athletes can receive. You know, it used to be just straight scholarships. Now it's extended to what's called cost of attendance to provide them a stipend to have a more suitable living wage to handle some travel expenses, to handle some laundry expenses, to take your boyfriend or girlfriend out for a date, those types of things that some other students are able to do. So there's been good movements in that, and also good movements in terms of trying to balance the student athlete experience so that they're I think we were probably getting out of control, and it's still so. I think people still underestimate just how hard of a life it is for the student athlete. They get a lot, but they give a lot, and in terms of their time and their sweat and their passion, and so it's a tough lifestyle. So it's something that we'll just have to keep monitoring and see what happens. But I'm glad to see things that have been made more available to student athletes and their families, and hopefully we can make the best experience possible for them at USF.
Right. I mean, it's hard to keep some of these athletes in college, you know, the ones that want to turn pro and are good enough to do that because they want to, you know, make money. And I personally don't think athletes should be paid in college, but I know it's a big issue, and I just wanted to kind of get your thoughts on that big issue. As in your position, Michael, what are the challenges that you face and that, you know, people who are, you know, athletic directors and VPs and athletic departments, what are the biggest issues that you face in college sports today?
Well, it's all hand in hand with the question you just asked. It really does come down to resources, the types of facilities we want to provide our student athletes, the everything that before you even get to paying considering paying student athletes more, you're talking about the scholarships that you're already paying for, the staffs and the facilities and the programs you're trying to provide them. It's as costs go up, as keeping up and wanting to live up to the expectations that the young men and women have to compete, but also our fans and others to win. It's a tough balance because everybody wants to be at the same level of what you see winning championships, and it's our expectation and goal to win championships. But from my prism, I take losses so hard because sometimes fans will take losses hard and they'll say, oh, well, it's the coach or it's the quarterback or it's the whoever. And for me, from my prism, I take it that, man, did we give our young men and women enough to win? I want our people to go in with a fair, you know, fair battle armor to compete. And if we're not as an institution, and that's all of us, that's our institution, that's our academic department, that's our donors, that's our fans. Folks, if you're not putting them out there fully armed to go against who they're going against, then how can you really expect a different result? And so for me, it is all about resources. And that's why for me, it's still starting off with how can we feed them better? How can we give them better facilities? How can we make their life better to make them bigger, faster, stronger, and smarter to prepare them to win the games and to win championships, but then also to help prepare them for life? Because again, less than 1% of our 475 student athletes are ever going to play any sort of pro. And so when you really look at it, the numbers of that type of caliber, which is amazing because these young men and women are amazing at what they do. So it just kind of shows you the type of elite talent to play at the last level, which you've been so close to so many legends of all sports for so many years in your career, Anne. And that's what's so fascinating to me about being around greatness, because people are so elite and their talents are just amazing. So I love to watch people at their best. And in my role, I love to try to do whatever I can to facilitate them being at their best, whatever that potential might be.
It's so true. And to prepare them, whether they are amateur athletes for the rest of their lives or make it into the pro ranks, they still need that education. They still need the academic background. So, you know, your role is very important, and we appreciate you being here, Michael Kelly, and I really enjoyed hearing your insight on a variety of topics about college sports and your background. Phenomenal. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a great journey. And thanks so much for all you do for the university. We're so proud of all you've accomplished in your career, and the fact that you still keep a soft spot in your heart and keep us at the front of mind is very much appreciated.
Sweet. Thanks so much. Michael Calais, VP, USF Athletics. Sports Interview with Anne Liguori is brought to you in part by Dune Jewelry and the Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. Dune Jewelry, that's D-U-N-E jewelry.com. And Sports Interview is brought to you in part by Peak Vision Sunglasses, P-E-A-K Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game, peakvision.com. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. I am at the Valspar Championship in the USF Suite, my alma mater. Very, very proud of USF Go Bulls. And joining me is the Executive Director of the USF Alumni Association, Bill McCausland. Bill, thanks so much for being on Sports Interview.
It is my pleasure. It's a beautiful day. Glad to be here.
It's so great to catch up with all my buddies from University of South Florida, located in Tampa, Florida, where I went to school, and all my siblings came here. And it's just a real exciting university. It's grown a lot, obviously, since you and I were students here at USF. But talk a little bit about what the biggest changes have been, maybe in the last 10, 15 years. I mean, it's been longer than that for us, but
how much time do we have? Because there's been a lot. The university's been on an amazing trajectory, really, over the last 20 years. We're at 340,000 alumni right now. We have about 51,000 students that are in. Every class, every year, is more accomplished than the one prior to it. We really have elevated in our national rankings and across the board everything. We are the 43rd largest public research university in the country. We recently were named, and something we're very, very proud of, we received the designation of a preeminent university within the state of Florida. There are only three universities that have received that designation, two of which, Florida State University and the University of Florida, have a 100-year head start on us. So we're a relatively young university, opened our doors in September of 1960, and yet we've reached these lofty heights and are continuing even beyond that, across the board in everything that we're doing. So we're very, very proud of where we've been, and we're proud of where we are right now. We're proud of our alumni, our students, and we are very optimistic and very excited about what the future holds.
So tell me a little bit more about that designation, to be receiving the preeminence designation in the state of Florida. How hard is it to get that?
It's very hard. What it is, and I won't get too down to the weeds on this, but there are 12 criteria that you have to make 11 of these 12 criteria. And they're performance-based metrics. They have to do with graduation rates and retention rates and test scores and doctoral appointments and these types of things, endowment values and so on. And you have to meet 11 of the 12. And USF last year was able to make the 11th of the 12. In order to receive it. Again, there's only three universities, and so it is difficult to achieve. We're very pleased that the state of Florida has this program, that they have this preeminence type of programs. It does mean additional funding to the university when we receive that designation, which is great, so that we can put that back into our programs and initiatives to continue to grow and continue to get even better. I will say there is a national program. One of our goals, and this was our president's goal from when she was first became our president in 2000. Now she's retiring in 2019. But one of her goals was that we'd be part of what is known as the American Association of Universities. It might be an Association of American Universities, but it's known as AAU. And it's really 62 of the top universities in all of North America. And that is our next step. That is what we have our eyes on. And so everything we're doing, preeminence is a great, I always say preeminence was just a milestone along our long journey, along this path that we're going. And it's something that we will celebrate and we will continue on. And we're looking towards the future and towards being one of the top 60, 100 universities in the United States.
And so what's all involved with the AAU designation, Bill? I mean, I'm sure it's very hard to get, but I understand, you know, some of the major universities across the country have that designation. How many have it? Most major universities or very few?
I believe it's 62. Okay. Might be 61, might be 63, but I'll say 62. But if it's the Harvards and Yales and Stanfords and University of Chicago's and Northwestern's, it's those universities. In the state of Florida, the University of Florida is the only AAU university. It's interesting. It is a process where you're invited to be a member of the AAU. You don't apply. You don't nominate yourself. You are invited. And there is not written criteria. There's not something that you can look at a checklist and say, we've done this, we've done that, we've done that. But we know what these universities look like. We know what their qualifications are, what their criteria are. We know what they're accomplishing, and we are striving to accomplish the same. Well, a lot of it is student success metrics and other things. So it's one of these things that if we just continue to grow, that we hope someday we will be invited to be a member of that and be one of the top universities in all of North America.
And another highlight recently was that USF got Phi Beta Kappa, the prestigious honor society on board, which is another distinction.
It is, and I am certainly not a Phi Beta Kappa expert. I'm not even a Phi Beta Kappa member.
We can't even pronounce it.
I know. But it is an honorary society for students, arts and sciences students at the top universities. As an example, every AAU university that we just talked about has a Phi Beta Kappa chapter. So we know we would like to have a Phi Beta Kappa chapter also, and that is something that we have applied for and just received that designation. The Phi Beta Kappa organization only grants this on an every three-year basis. So it's a long process. There's an application, if you will. There's an evaluation. There's on-site interviews. They really exhaustively look at your university and make sure that you're deemed worthy of this type of chapter, and we received it this year. So we'll have our first Phi Beta Kappa class in the fall.
So University of South Florida, I understand that it's very tough to get in to USF.
Getting tougher and tougher.
Behind what, University of Florida, maybe as the second in the state? Is that what I've learned?
I think it is. Our class is more and more accomplished every year. Many, many years ago, USF has always been a great university, but many years ago, it was more of a fallback school, and it was more of a safety school for people, for students coming out of high school. Now it is a destination. It is a school of choice. We have valedictorians and salutatorians are saying, I want to go to the University of South Florida and get my education there because it is a top education. Our class, as I said, is more accomplished every year. This incoming class, the average GPA was 4.08, average high school GPA. The average SAT score, and I'm going to be in the neighborhood on this, was 1250. You know, very high. Yeah, you say, wow. I say, wow, and I think, thank goodness I got into USF way back when, because I'm not sure I would get in now.
That's why I'm saying wow.
Yeah, exactly. But what it is it just shows that Our students, the incoming students and our students that are there, are the top students, and they are getting a great education, and they are coming there for the right reasons, and they're benefiting from it, and then they're graduating and doing wonderful things as they become one of our 340,000 and growing alumni.
I love your energy and your enthusiasm for USF. It just seems like everybody that I talk to who graduate from USF has so much passion for this university, and it's infectious, and it's contagious, and isn't it?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and I've worked at a couple universities, and everyone loves their university, but at USF, the emotional attachment that students have when they graduate is unbelievable. It is so strong. People have a great experience at USF for the most part. I'm not saying 100%, but for the most part, students have a wonderful experience. They have a strong emotional attachment, and they want to stay connected to the university forever. I always say, and it's interesting, you're a student for 4 or 5 years, but you're an alum for 50, 60, 70 years. The majority of your life, your connection to USF is going to be as an alum, and we're fortunate that these students, when they graduate, they want to stay connected because of the experience they had.
And you mentioned alum. You're the executive director of the USF Alumni Association, and I've had the honor of hosting a program that you put together called the Outstanding Young Alumna Awards, right? And it's just amazing to see the accomplishments of these men and women who are under the age of 35, right?
We started this program about 12 or 15 years ago, and it's called the Outstanding Young Alumni Awards, and it's for graduates 35 and under. And we have 100,000 alumni under the age of 35, and which is just amazing, and so many of them are so accomplished. In fact, we used to just give out one award a year. We did this for about 8 or 10 years, and then we looked at it and we said, we have so many accomplished people, we need to give out more than one. We need to give it out to 6 or 8 or 10 awards recipients. We have our event coming up in May where there's 5 new recipients, and they're all just amazing. In fact, it's funny. I look at what these folks have accomplished at 35, and I think, what have I done in my life? And I'm much older than 35. I feel like such a slacker, but I'm also so proud of what they've done. And I hope and I think and I really believe that USF has had a significant part of their success, that the foundation at our university has helped them, has assisted in their success at a young age, and will assist for the rest of their life.
And in New York, Bill, I have the opportunity to meet a lot of graduates who are just superstars. I mean, we have authors, we have broadcasters, we have engineers, we have musicians, we have actors. I mean, there's just such a variety that somehow find New York City after graduating from USF and are not only succeeding, but they're thriving. It's really, really exciting to see.
There are, again, 340,000 alumni, and so many of them are accomplished in whatever their life's calling is, whatever their profession is. We have, I'll use as an example, one of our young alumni recipients this year. She's a teacher in the Bronx, and she won the Grammy Educator of the Year Award last year. The Grammy Award for the Educator of the Year, and we are honoring her this year. And she just was named a finalist, one of 10 finalists for the Global Educator of the Year, $1 million prize for Global Educator of the Year, the only person from the United States. The other 9 recipients are outside of the United States, and she's from University of South Florida from Tampa. How great is that?
That, and she's a teacher?
And she's a teacher in the
Bronx. $1 million would go a long way, because they never give teachers enough respect, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure how that million, I know it says $1 million prize, and I'm not sure how it's allocated, but I hope that part of that goes to her. I hope it's significant, because she doesn't get, in fact, I spoke with her just, it was last week or maybe 2 weeks ago, and she said the day before in the Bronx they had named it, her name is Melissa Salguero, and they had named it Melissa Salguero Day in the Bronx. And I thought, how great is that? And this is a lady who's a school teacher who's making a difference in young people's life as a music teacher. She's getting people to come to school. She's getting people to stay in school because of her music curriculum. And she's under the age of 35.
Wow, that's great. USF roars in Go Bulls in New York City. Valspar Championship, it's, you know, we're coming close to the Masters. I know you're a big golfer, and I know you follow the sport, Bill. You're very astute. You follow a lot of things. I can talk to you about any number of subjects, but let's talk a little golf, and Masters is right around the corner. Who are you looking toward to excel at Augusta National?
Well, I have a favorite, I guess as all of us do, and as Jordan Spieth. And the reason is, and not to prolong the question or the answer to the question, is that he went to the same high school I went to. And I went to Dallas Jesuit High School. And it's funny, the couple, my brother and my brother-in-law, we all went to Jesuit High School. And whenever Jordan is playing, we'll get on the phone and talk to each other as if he was our classmate, as if he was our buddy. You know, how's our buddy Jordan doing? Hey, Jordan did this. I mean, he's 30 years younger than me. I'm old enough to be his father. But he still, I have a soft spot because he went to Dallas Jesuit. He also went to the University of Texas, where I went my undergraduate. Graduate at the University of South Florida, go Bulls. But so I do pull for him. I'm a big golf fan. I am a golfer, but not a great golfer, but I am a big golf fan, and I love the Masters, and I do plan to spend a lot of time on the weekend watching the Masters tournament. Of course, you know, it's anyone's game at that point, and it's a matter of, you know, is Dustin Johnson hot, or is Tiger coming back, or there's any number of folks, but I'll always be pulling for Jordan.
And Isn't it great here at the Valspar Championship that University of South Florida has this suite overlooking the 18th green? We just saw Jason Day come through. We just saw John Rahm birdie from a bunker shot. And, you know, it's just a great spectator sport, and to have USF so close to all the action right here with all these alums right here at the Valspar, you can't get any better than this. I love having a studio here, yeah. Bill.
It's a beautiful studio, and it's a beautiful day. We're very fortunate. We have, through the generosity of some of our alumni, they have donated the money to allow us to have this tent on the 18th green. And this is maybe 5, 6, 7 years in a row. I'm not sure how many years it's been. So we are not spending USF money. We're not spending foundation money. We're not spending donation money to do this. We're doing it through the generosity of our donors. And we're able then to have our guests, have our key donors, our key volunteers, our key alumni out as our guests over the next 4 days to enjoy the beautiful day, the beautiful course, a fantastic field in the tournament. And just can't get any better than this, especially with today's weather. It's just, in the next 4 days are going to be fantastic. So,
and it's just a pleasure always working with you, Bill McCausland, the executive director of the Alumni Association for University of South Florida. Thanks for sharing your insight, and go Bulls.
Go Bulls. Thank you for your time.
My thanks to the University of South Florida, to Steve Blair, to Steve Bradley, Bill McCausland, and to Tracy West of the Valspar Championship. And to Kyle Lynch, our brilliant engineer. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. I'll talk to you next Saturday morning from 9 to 10 right here on Sports Interview with Ann Liguori.